At times, it may seem the more troubling features of our collective cultural experience, polarization, conflict, isolation, appear so intractable they are now to be expected as almost normalized behaviors of modern community life. They are not. Each one of us has the natural intelligence and creativity to transcend polarities with a greater perspective, transform the energy of conflict into resolution, and live an authentic life true to our self-chosen path, beliefs, and values. At any time, we can make a conscious decision that can alter our life, relationships, and community. In this conversation, Aviv Shahar is joined by Jason Diggs, artist, philosopher, teacher, and author of Conflict Equals Energy. Jason is a global leader of the Authentic Relating Movement. Join us for Can You Be Authentic?
Throughout history, the great questions have been asked, and great research has been undertaken, always expanding the territory of the known by shining a light into the unknown. Where is that cutting edge today? And can a community of people from all over the world, each carrying their own unique journey of discovery, come together to inquire at the edge of purposeful evolution through conversation? At Portals of Perception, we think it is possible, and we hope that you will choose to be a part of this exploration.
Central to the Portals project is our inquiry into who and what we humans are and how we are evolving. Our premise is that humanity has entered a critical and profound shift, a shift that involves struggle and turmoil and great development possibilities. Inside this shift, we are called to rediscover our deeper nature and unlock the regenerative and evolutionary promise of this moment. Jason Digg is a leader in the human connection movement that emerged over the last two decades. He's the author of Conflict Equal Energy, the transformative practice of authentic relating, where he tells the story of the authentic relating phenomenon and describes its core ideas and practices. He is equal parts artist, philosopher, teacher, and media producer. We want today to learn about his journey, the authentic relating movement he has helped shape, and where and how is this unfolding story evolving next. Jason, welcome.
Thank you, Aviv. It's wonderful to be here.
So I would like to ask you right at the get-go, what are you paying attention to right now? What is the kind of shift that you are monitoring at this time? You've been surfing this wave over the last few decades. Where is your mind and focus right now?
Yeah, my new project is called Authentic at Work. And I see this broad swing in our culture. In the 70s, you know, our interiors and the human potential movement was so interesting. And then, you know, psychedelics were outlawed and there was this big swing back to the right in America in the 80s and a much more conservative. And I think at that time, a lot of these ideas went into the underground. You know, the human potential movement made the cover of Time magazine, right? It was a mainstream event. And then I think for almost 30 years, it actually went underground, and specifically in the business world. Like the business world was like, we're rejecting everything that has to do with interiors and feelings. And I think that pendulum is actually swinging back. And most small and medium-sized companies are really looking at like, well, how do we have wellness at work? How do we treat people as whole human beings? And I think the larger corporations are going to have to follow suit as well, because it's just a trend. It's an idea whose time has come in humanity. And so My current project is taking all of the authentic relating practices, which have been in development for over 15 years in the personal growth world, and translating them. So it's a big translation project, which is, I believe, my dharma and in the world is to really translate these practices, these wisdom practices, into plain language and applicable practices.
What are the core challenges in the translation work?
Oh, cool. I love you're asking this right in the beginning. So to be quite frank and honest, myself and a lot of my colleagues, authentic relating is this really interesting decentralized open source movement. So it's actually a practice that's being led by 20 people or 200 people, depending on how you count it. And there's people leading this practice all over the world. And so many of my colleagues have tried to bring authentic relating into business and failed, and myself included. And I think because there's this fundamental cross purposes that happen, if you ask people to slow down and you ask people to tell the truth, things get less efficient. Things get worse before they get better. Any system of people, because I think businesses really thrive on like, okay, well, suppress everything that's happening for you and get the job done. And when you are done with work at the end of the day, then you can, you know, vent with your partner or your therapist or your friends and get all that stress out. And then you come back to work the next day and you have to suppress, you can't tell the truth at work because it'll actually blow up your relationships. And I think we're just getting to the point in humanity where we have enough abundance and consciousness to realize that, like, oh, it's actually not worth it. It's actually not worth it to suppress and, you know, treat people like cogs in a wheel so that we could get the job done. We actually have to figure out a way that works for everyone. And yeah, so that's the biggest one.
Yeah. Well, so I may be a bit of the exception there, because I actually managed to fly a high level corporate kind of effort and with senior leadership teams in the Fortune 100 space, not doing authentic relating, but doing the slowing down and the art of reflection in a deep way. So there is, how I found the way to do this is a conversation by itself, but we are today to explore your journey. I admire that you are leading this. And what I feel in the very brief story you're already telling there is that the new generations coming into the workforce, they're going to force it because they're not prepared to leave this separation, artificial separation of not being sourced in themselves in the work they do. And so they are the power you're using as you're leading this idea of authentic at work. Very compelling.
Yeah, and I think it has existed at the top levels in corporations for several decades. You know, one of my mentors is Fred Kaufman, and he was doing that work for many years and, you know, ended up as one of the top executives of LinkedIn. And I think what's happening is this bottom-up pressure of like the millennials are not just not going to take any BS, and like they're not actually going to split themselves into two to be able to like work for some narcissistic leader. And so there's this bottom-up pressure, and like the knowledge of wellness and how to slow down and how to actually be an embodied human being and wholeness, really, it's a practice of wholeness. I think it's actually trickling down more towards the middle management, and I think it's very much needed.
So let's talk for a bit, Sid, here on the front end of the conversation, the central idea, the big idea in conflict, equal energy, and why you wrote the book and what is it you endeavor to communicate in the book.
Yeah, I love that you're asking this. And I'm a storyteller by nature. You know, I was a video producer for many years, over a decade, working for Ken Wilber. But like, I studied storytelling and script writing, and I think in themes a lot. And so the reason I wrote the book is because the authentic relating movement really has been led by a dozen people. I'm one of many leaders. It is this open source, decentralized movement. And no one had systematized it into one place. It was really an oral tradition that went forward in all these different courses. And so you had the circling movement, and the authentic relating movement. And we all kind of loosely understood what the central ideas were, but we were all teaching it slightly different and there was slightly different language. And so I really wanted to bring it into one place of like, here's everything. And it really is written as a practical manual, very useful for facilitators. It's a full curriculum and I write it in a very pithy way where it's like, I talk about one of the big ideas, like, you know, chapter one is called polarity. So I talk about one of the big ideas for three pages, and then I bring it directly to a tool that applies this in your life. And so it's 12 chapters and 30 tools. And it just goes back and forth between this like conceptual, philosophical, and very, very practical. And I think that's indicative of my own personality. And so the idea of conflict equals energy came to me while I was on an airplane. I had like a leadership manual that I had written for my advanced students. And I was like, maybe I could rewrite this into a book. And I had the idea of taking out the theme of leadership and facilitation and installing another theme that would really allow me to tell the whole story of all of the authentic relating practices as I saw them. And conflict equals energy came because I think, honestly, it has to do with the Karate Kid. This amazing central movie of the late 80s. You know, in the Karate Kid, there's like this wax on, wax off, you know, sand the deck, paint the fence. There's all of these basic things that we do. So in authentic relating, we share impact. We practice emotional clarity in and of ourselves. We practice boundaries. We practice welcome everything, assume nothing, like all of these different things that we do in our relationships, right? But the advanced authentic relating is actually to be able to transmute the energy of a situation in a way that creates clarity, connection, and teamwork from conflict. And this is something, you know, I mentioned Fred Kaufman. I saw him do this again and again when I was, you know, at the early Integral Institute seminars. I was the sound guy behind the sound booth, like watching Fred work his magic. And someone would have an upset within themselves or an upset with even the course or with him. And he would just get present and he would listen and he would reflect. And then 10 minutes late, like the whole room, you know, there'd be 40 people in the room. They would be so engaged. Like you could hear a pin drop because everyone was so engaged because of his level of presence and level of listening. And 10 minutes later, there would be this transformation. You could palpably feel the resolution in this person's energetic and emotional system. And what did he do? He transformed something that was turbulent and had, you know, static in it. It's like when our energetic emotional experience has static or turbulence in it, that's a sign that the universe is trying to tell us something and we need to go into presence and take multiple perspectives and transmute that energy. And so the idea of conflict equals energy is meant to be this intriguing theme that catches people in people's attention. But honestly, I don't really tell them what that means until chapter 11 and 12. So it's a foreshadowing of what I believe authentic or advanced authentic relating is.
Yeah, powerful. So you've kind of just done now a nucleus download of the whole Torah in just a few minutes. And what we want to do is retell this story even slower and go into some of the practices you just named in a deeper way. And we want to do that and tell two other stories in parallel, which is your personal story and how you got to do this work, and also the bigger arc story that you already started to see it in terms of the potential movement and how the phenomena that you've been engaged in is, it has harvested much of what was occurring in the field. I'm just still processing the way you're describing your experience with Fred Kaufman, and what you're describing to me sounds, we won't talk about it in corporate settings, but it has a transmogrifying shamanic capacity where the energetic configuration that's emergent in the room, because somebody, in this case, the facilitator, the leader, is able to take it all in and make space for it, then that enables the pattern that was generated in the room to get rewired re-architected and be transformed to a whole other experience that's invitational for everybody else. That's the way I've heard that accounting from you. What would you restate there or say differently?
Well, I'll thank you for the compliment that I summarized the Torah. I don't know if I can take that compliment in. That's really big. But precisely, you know, the way I think of leadership is, so I have a friend who does equine assisted therapy, and horses, their energetic emotional system is so interesting because their heart is 5 times bigger than ours. Like if you take your fist and like your heart is about this big, well, their heart is 5 times as big as that. And then the energetic field is actually that big and that strong. And so horses, they're so energetically sensitive. And if you have a talented equine therapist, they can, you know, bring you into the paddy with, you know, this fenced in grassy area with a group of horses, and they can point out these different dynamics, and they can actually show you your own consciousness and your own energy happening out there in their fields because they're so energetically sensitive. And I had a friend who brought me out a couple years ago, maybe 2 springs ago, and I learned a lot about leadership from the horses, because the mare or the gelding that's the leader, their energetic consciousness is wide enough and big enough to encompass the whole paddy, the whole fenced in area. And everything's happening inside their nervous system, so to speak. Everything that's happening with the other horses is happening inside of their nervous system. And so what an amazing responsibility this is as a leader. I'm wondering why I went into that. Oh, because you summarized this idea of, you know, Fred was doing something magical. You know, he was doing these techniques that we can learn. We can learn to reflect. We can learn to listen. We can learn to ask curious questions, and instead of give people advice or leading questions, you know, we can learn these skills. But what he was doing was actually a inner energetic posture that allowed energy to transform.
Yes.
You may have gone into this story for another invisible reason, but I'm completely messing up my choreography here for our conversation, which might be the thing to do. There is a, in you sharing the insight and the story, it brought up an experience I've never talked about, not on camera, profound experience with horses at a time when I was very desperate to seek a new insight. This is the late 90s. And I went on a retreat in East Washington in a place called Iconi Ranch, which is a place with a large herd of horses. And I told on the second day my wife and the other family that were with us that I'm just going to go away to travel by myself a bit into the woods and see what will happen. And I'm going to have to make up my mind whether I'm going to leave this in the recording or edit this out, but I'm just going with the flow because of what you shared. And I came to a cliff right at the edge of a canyon, and something called me back, and I set myself down by a beautiful oak tree, and I started reading piece of writing that was very important for me at the time, and I was so desperate to find my next insight, and I read it out loud, and then I looked up and I saw the wild herd of horses beginning to gather, and in a split of a second I knew what was about to happen, and it had a kind of a clairvoyant knowing, and I kept on reading, and they gathered and they formed an exact ring around me. Now, I'm not a person that been with horses. If you haven't been near these large creatures, you would typically be frightened because they're very large and powerful. The only time I've been on a horse was the day before when we took a first lesson in riding horses. So something in me knew what was about to happen, I instructed myself not to be afraid because that would scare them. And they gathered around me in an exact ring, some 36 horses or so. And then from the back, as I was reading out loud, 2 or 3 horses came near and sniffed me all around, which I'm told is a way of them telling me everything is fine. And through this entire experience, I felt a tremendous sense of renewal and rejuvenation. And then I got up and I said, well, let's test if this is for real or if I'm just imagining. And I set myself to begin to walk back to the main area of the ranch. They all lined up in a line just behind me. And as I was, it's about 15, 20 minutes walk, as I was getting closer, they all started running to the main area of the ranch. And the ranch owner came out and said to me, what has happened? Can you tell me what has happened? Because they never just come back, the herd never just come back to the ranch in this way. And I told him what has happened. And he said, you're very, very lucky. This has only happened once to one other person. And they kind of accepted you into their way of being. And yeah, there you go. That's the, I've never told this story, not on camera, but that was at a time when I've had a deep search, a kind of a searching prayer, and needed to find an answer. And I realized the answer was not where I was looking for it. I was going to receive it from the natural worlds. And I did through that experience.
Beautiful. What a striking visual image. And I think one of the things that I learned from these beings is just how energetically sensitive we are as living creatures. And they may be a little bit more sensitive to me, but like every human I'm talking to in my life is absorbing so much energy from me that's happening below the surface.
So I'm going to try and get back the reins of my choreography after this story, which is fine. By leading us to, you write somewhere that appreciation and curiosity are your religion. So I'm interested to ask you, where do you trace your curiosity to? What is the genesis? Are you able to say, you know, I was always like this? What was there a formative event that you trace this sense of awakened curiosity to?
Yeah. Well, I was always very curious and very creative as a young person. And music was a very big part of my life, starting as a teenager. But I can trace it directly to Almas and the Diamond Approach. So this is a transpersonal psychology school, a modern day spiritual path. And he has this central idea that curiosity can take you all the way home. And it's not just like a human curiosity of like, oh, I want to like learn a new thing. Like we're attracted to novelty, you know, and we all have a natural curiosity, which is very strong as children. But what he's teaching is something like a spiritual curiosity or radical curiosity. And it's like wanting to know the truth for just to know the truth. And it's like, it's a love of the truth as well. And there's something about that teaching that I really took on, you know, working with him directly and working in one of those groups for 7 years in my formative years before I began teaching. And I still think that school is the basis of my worldview and of how I see the human condition. So, yeah.
And you write also that the path that brought you here is long and winding. And like any good story, because you're a storyteller, it starts with an epiphany. One day you realize that you could become aware of the rules of this human game and learn to bend those rules, a bit like Neo in the Matrix.
Yeah. Yeah, you're reading from the preface of my book, which has my personal story in it. And it's really a creative way to say the most advanced tool in authentic relating, or kind of the most advanced introductory tool, is called setting context. Mm. And it's becoming context aware. So when we're not context aware, we're just going along with what's happening. And if you're going along with what's happening, that means someone else is setting the context. Could be your society, could be, you know, the leader of your company or whatever it is. And we're like fish in a river. We're inside the context. And context aware is almost like becoming a flying fish and coming above the river and saying, oh, that's the thing that I've been swimming in. And when we have that initial epiphany of like, that's the thing that I've been swimming in, those are the rules that I've been playing by without even knowing I was playing the rules, we can begin to shift or begin to ask ourselves a fundamental question, which is, what game am I playing? And do I actually want to be playing that game? And so this passage in the preface that you're referring to is foreshadowing chapter 9, which is about context. And our empowerment really, I think, comes from our ability to see the context that we're in and then make a conscious decision of, like, do I want to play that game? Like, is Monopoly working for me? Or do I want to, like, Monopoly and Stratego is what I grew up with. You know, maybe I actually want to write my own game and I want to make a card deck that doesn't have 52 cards. Maybe it has 100 cards and, like, and I want to play the possibility game.
Yeah, who needs the minor arcana when you can get to the bigger game, yes?
Exactly.
What I perceived, which is, it's fascinating to get your interpretation for this paragraph. What I perceived when I read this, let me say it back to you so you can disabuse me of my perception or say, no, that's exactly right. I perceived in that more than the traditional sense of awakening. And in my observation, I'd say that most people travel through life continually repeating the same pattern, the same struggle, the same kind of karmic pattern. The people, the details, they vary and change, but they recurringly recreate the same pattern. I'd say maybe 85 to 90% of people, just for framing sake. Then you'd say that maybe there are 9% of people that are able to transcend and graduate from that pattern, only to discover what? That now they need to learn to integrate another, whole other pattern and transcend that. And that maybe is the 9%. Then you have the 1% or the 1% of the 1% that are able to somehow engage with the source code and potentially are able to swiftly go through several patterns in one lifetime. In developmental terms, you say that they were genuinely able to transcend and integrate more than one or two stages. That's very, very rare. Most mentally people can skate there quickly, but to truly embody those, it's rare. So when I read that paragraph, I thought that what it meant, and now you're offering this other framing of context, which is very much telling the story in the same way, just from another point of view.
Yeah. Well, I think the Matrix is one of the most powerful symbols and myths to enter our culture in the last 25 years. And, you know, we're a culture that's built on myths, but like the old stories don't hold water anymore.
So I'm interested, Jason, that we do just a little more weaving of your personal story. What else, by way of formative personal experience, would you reflect on that shaped the kind of work you're doing today?
Yeah, my early 20s was really marked by trying to understand my Christian upbringing and a study of integral Christianity. I spent most of my late 20s doing that because I grew up in a very born-again Christian church. My uncle was the pastor. There was a lot of ecstasy. There was a lot of, you know, electric guitar and saxophone and these long worship services and people, you know, exclaiming in ecstasy to the person of Jesus. And then, you know, the sermon would be another couple hours long. And the sermon was filled with so much dogma and so much like shame and guilt motivation for people to behave a certain way. And when I rejected the church early on, you know, when I was maybe 15 or 16 and started playing music and smoking pot. But I actually went back to the church in my early 20s for almost a year because my parents divorced. And like, I really, at that time, I was really looking at like this spirituality, this spiritual world that was painted to me of like angels and demons and, you know, born again Christian churches, they're into the gifts of the spirit. So they would speak in tongues and they would lay hands on people and like, and these very energetically powerful experiences through worship and prayer that infused so much to me as a child. And then, you know, after being in the church for about a year between the ages of 23 and 24, you know, politically in America, this was shortly after 9/11. And like, I couldn't hang with the dogma of the church, you know, and I was a black sheep there in a lot of ways, because I just didn't believe in the whole afterlife and the punishing God and all these things. And I would ask too many questions. I was way too curious. And so I spent my late 20s after moving to Boulder and starting to work for Ken Wilber, trying to reconcile these two things. Like, how could the church have so much spiritual juice and beauty, and it had come so close to my soul and was so inside my heart? You know, the scriptures, I know a lot of this, the scriptures and the stories that Jesus would tell, and they influenced me and guided my life. And I really just did think of Jesus as my guru in a lot of ways. After studying Eastern religion and going back to Christianity and then going to integral Christianity, I really did think of this person as my main teacher, because he lived inside me and I prayed to him almost every day. And so I spent a long time trying to reconcile that with the dogma that I think makes the church so, so harmful. And so that's the emotional, spiritual part of the story. But the career, professional start part of the story is I started working for Ken Wilber doing video when I was 26 years old. And I did that very intimately for about 5 years, creating a lot of content for the Integral Institute and Integral Naked, and you know, filmed dozens and dozens of seminars and brought that material, you know, on integral psychology and integral Buddhism and integral Christianity and integral leadership and all of these teachers, and then taking all of that material back into the computer and creating hundreds of video clips. And so I became a media producer and, you know, continued that career as a freelancer and, you know, still working for some of the teachers in the integral community. So my main mentors were Diane Hamilton and Terry Patton and Jeff Salzman. Those were the people that I spent the most time learning from just in all of those early workshops.
And what was that experience like for you to be behind the camera and watch the experience? People are very much immersed in the experience and you are inside that same immersion, but you're also looking at that experience through the lens of the camera.
Yeah, you know, I got paid to go to grad school. I mean, I didn't get paid much, but I got paid to go to grad school for integral psychology and integral theory. And these were my professors and teachers. And it was also very fulfilling to serve them, to be setting up the microphones and setting up the cameras and doing some of the logistics for the workshops. I remember we had one, it was called the iWet. Ken had all these interesting sexual innuendos in some of his products, but the Integral Weekend Experiential Training, iWet. And we would actually fly to all these different cities around the world. And I was the logistical technical person that would fly, go on the road with these folks. And so it was very, very fulfilling to be of service and to see people's journeys. And of course I was absorbing in the background for a decade before I started teaching. So I was always contemplating and synthesizing in the background.
So you already started to map the story of the human potential movement and how that is ancestral in a way to what you are describing as that early first decade of the 21st century. And I want us to now develop further the origin story in that of what became authentic relating and the human connection movement. I'm wondering whether it going to be productive for me to tell the story that from where I sit, more the two centuries stories, and then for you to drop other parts in it and evolve the actual experience of how authentic relating came together. How about that as an approach, or would you want to do it differently?
I would love that.
Okay.
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, so I am always very interested in this idea of recurring patterns. And it's for me, it's the not so much the study of history as his story, that's history, because history is more the study of who is controlling who and who subjugated who and the victors and the vanquished. The other inquiry I call more the inquiry of her story. It's more the inquiry after the invisible patterns that show up through time. And one simple example is we can identify that there was clearly a spiritual impulse that was arising in the middle of the 19th century. For example, through the Theosophical movement. And one of its characters was the integration of East and West. And then you see a similar fractal reappearing into the 60s and 70s in the coming together of the human potential movement, the New Age, the early phases of the New Age. So in a similar way, equally interested in this very interesting polarity that's emerging in the early 20th century in, of all places, Vienna and that part of Europe, where you have somebody like Freud who is researching and hoping to truly develop what will be recognized as a credible science, credible psychoanalytical science. And he's passionate about his work. And you have, in a similar time, a person just 5 years younger than him, in Rudolf Steiner, showing up in the same part of the world. Probably at some point they are frequenting the same art events and or similar coffee places and such. And his inquiry is in a different lane. He is inquiring into the spiritual and the mystical. So you have these two, and they probably know of each other and disapprove of each other's work, but when you step back and look at what those two figures represent, and maybe you drop a third name there, okay, 5 years younger than Steiner in Gurdjieff. And he shows up with his work. And if you tell the story of that phase, what becomes evident is Freud is believing that we have reached a certain end in terms of human perception, a certain wall, and we need to go beyond that to integrate the unconscious. Steiner is teaching his students to do something else, to integrate the mystical, and is leading his students to develop spiritual organs to be able to read into and integrate what he calls the higher worlds. Gurdjieff leads his student in a different path into freedom. He's essentially saying, you are captured. You're captured by all your automatic programming. You are possessed by everything that prevents you from being human. And if you are to become truly naturalized human, you're going to have to break out of those patterns, and I'm going to have to lead you into the fourth way. And if you drop another name there too, Ouspensky, he is too, even though he's obviously learning massively from Gurdjieff, he's also learning and claiming that something about the human experience has reached an edge. So you have this spiritual impulse that's arising in the early part of the 20th century, and then we have these two massive events, First and Second World War, that belongs in a different trace and a different time, but you could say snuff out the life out of that spiritual impulse that's arising in the early phases of the 20th century. So by the time the spiritual impulse regroups itself and comes, is showing up again into the 50s, 60s, 70s, more the early stages of the human potential movement, it now reappears in a different place. It's been removed from that original impulse, and obviously it's shaped largely by Jung and Maslow and others. And now I'm reading, Jason, that we're seeing 5 or 6 lanes co-arising. So you have the humanistic psychological lane, okay, obviously psychotherapy, but many other modalities, including gestalt therapy and so on. And then right next to it and somewhat overlapping to the humanistic psychological lane, you have the developmental lane, because obviously overlapping because there is developmental psychology, but you could legitimately see this as a unique lane in all the big names that the Maslow, the Piaget, the Erikson, the Graves, spiral dynamics, all of it you are experiencing at the frontier that's emerging in the early 2000s with the work of integral meta theory, where Ken Wilber integrates a lot of that work into a bigger map. Then you have the third lane, which is the esoteric mystical lane, some of the names we mentioned, but some of the people that follow them. And then I believe you have the fourth lane, which is very important in our context here today, which is the communal relational lane. And you have the Rogerian school and T groups and encounter groups. And some of that body of work that's emerging through the 60s and the 70s, where the integral framing, you will say, the unlock power is more in the lower left rather than in the upper left or the upper right. So they put the emphasis there. I do think there are two other lanes you can put together in this story. The fifth lane I'll describe as the various healing modalities that appear at the time. Genuinely, you can integrate into it even Feldenkrais work and Rolfing, but more other modalities of healing and so on. And I would integrate the sixth lane to be the activist environmental and ecological work. So this and these six lanes that are rising through the 60s and the 70s then are taken very much through the three vectors of influence that shape the 70, 80, 90 to the close of the 20th century, the three vectors being the rapid, extraordinary technological developments, the first, second computing revolution, all the way to the internet and what followed beyond that, the free market bonanza and the financialization of the economy and what that does and how those various inquiries and explorations are shaped because of the commercial and dynamic that are happening in that space. And the third vector is globalization and the massive acceleration of globalization all the way to somewhat the breakdown of globalization over the last decade. So that's how I will tell the story of the close of the 20th century and to bring us just up to date to where I believe is a scaffold for you to come back and weave then the even more detailed story of the authentic relating movement. Is that first decade of the 21st century, we have there this seminal event, which is the 07, 08, 09 crisis, which I believe is a symbolic event because it begins with the breakdown of the subprime mortgage story, which if you think about it financially is a story about exploitative and extractive modality, which plays on the exploitative and the extractive modality that played earlier in planetary resources. And right about the same time when that is broken, obviously the Occupy movement shows up, distributed leadership modalities are showing up. And incidentally, around about the same time, few famous gurus are imploding and the singular guru model is also breaking down. And if you integrate into it the story of the rise of social media, if you look at it from an exoteric eyes, you'd say, well, it's just a very fascinating coincidence. But when you look at it more from a flying upside down metaphysical or esoteric lens, you'd say something big is going on. There is some kind of an epochal shift, and it plays out through all these different facets and dimensions, not the least of which is that never in the history of time has there been a species that has experienced such a profound change in way of communication as we have through the round at the same time, the advent of the smartphone. So all of it is happening at the same time. And the reason I wanted so much for us to speak is because I'm perceiving in this story the rise authentic relating and the movement that you are part of to represent an important element that is seeking out to counter and balance some of the pathologies that emerged in all this story. So that's some of the ancestral story that I would weave. Please edit, reframe, or change anything from your perspective or add to it. And then I'm fascinated that you'll actually tell at what point do you know, you recognize that you're actually genuinely participating in a new movement.
Well, there's so many threads I could pick up there. I love the visual map that you offered, like the six lanes and the three vectors. And I noticed a palpable relief when you mentioned number five, which is the healing modalities. And I would say that the bioenergetic and embodiment trend is so, so important. I mean, we can look at the very surface level of that and look at yoga, but, you know, just people understanding breath and dance and movement as integrative force, I think is so, so important. Like, it's not just to keep our body healthy. It actually does integrate our emotions and our consciousness. And so the bioenergetic is so, so important because, you know, the spiritual can bring us up. The ascending current can bring us up and out and into, if we go too far, into a dissociative state. And so we need the descending current and the embodiment to really make sure that what we're doing is practical. And that's really my, I believe my karma and dharma is as a translator. So the book, I did my best to take out 90% of the personal growth jargon and put everything in plain language, partly because I didn't want it to be another niche thing. Like, the personal growth world is so niche, you know, it's people who can afford all of these workshops and most of them don't even have children. You know, it's like there's a lot that happens when people are inside of an echo chamber and just talking to people who are like them, that I think is a big disadvantage, you know, and this is the challenge with the current technological algorithms that we have, is it puts people in that echo chamber and only talking to people like them. And the people in your newsfeed are all thinking like you already. So why would you need to incorporate another perspective, right? But to look at the societal, I had one novel idea that I'll share while you were talking. It was so beautiful. You know, you have these broad trends where humanity moves forward by a big step or a big leap and consciousness becomes integrated. And where, you know, you mentioned Freud and Singer and Gurdjieff as the first one that you detailed. And I have such a connection to all three of these thinkers. And they are all different and so important. And then, you know, the First World War is kind of like a, you know, two steps forward, one step back kind of experience. And I think the Cold War is actually just as effective. And that's where I'll pick up the story is.
Well, let me just say, since you brought the Cold War, one of the main reasons why when we pick up that impulse into the 60s and the 70s, we are picking it up in a completely different place is because of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and what that does deep, not just in terms of the devastation, what that does to everything that's deep inside the human psyche. For the first time, children are born into a world where we know we have a complete, total destructive force to blow up this place. So please pick up the story, because that leads into the Cold War, really. It's the shaping event for the Cold War.
Exactly. So in the 60s, you had, you know, psychedelics expanding consciousness and, you know, people doing therapy using LSD and psilocybin. And then, you know, there was this T group movement. So all of the communal and relational practice was there. As I mentioned in the intro to this dialogue, like, it made the cover of Time magazine. There was 3,000 groups happening in America that were all relational groups. They were all groups based on developing your authenticity and relational practice, like working it out together. Because when we come together and there is friction and we bump up against one another, there's so much to learn. And what we need is authenticity and courage to lean into it. And then, you know, that relationship or the relational field of a group can teach us so much about how we're making meaning and do that developmental work of like, is there a higher way to make meaning, right? So relational practice really can accelerate development. It accelerates our emotional and social development. So you have the communal, and then you have the psychedelic and spiritual, but then the Cold War kind of like almost put a wet blanket on the fire, so to speak. Psychedelics were completely outlawed. You know, you had this propaganda of like reefer madness, you know, and like all of it was pushed into the counterculture and pushed into the underground and the fringe. And nowadays, you know, a lot of executives in companies are doing ayahuasca retreats. And so here we are, you know, 30, 40 years later, and like, it's actually opening back up. You have MAPS. Psilocybin is very close to being legalized in most places. It is legal in a lot of places. Ketamine therapy is legal, you know, through therapeutic modalities. And it's really, really interesting, the trends. And I am biased because it is my field, but I think relational practice becomes very, very central and very, very important for this. So what is relational practice? It's any time that we come into the here and now and focus on what's arising in the moment, which, as I said before, includes embodiment. So a big part of the journey that authentic relating brings us into is embodiment. Chapter 2 in my book is called Embodiment for that reason. And it's like interpreting all of these signals in here that are not necessarily speaking English or my native language. My head or my cognitive capacities speaks one language, but my heart and my intuition and my belly speaks a different language entirely. And we need interpretive frameworks to actually, like you said, be a whole human being, which is what Gurdjieff and Ouspensky were teaching. To be a whole human being, what they meant by the fourth way is you have a consciousness that is able to integrate your heart, head, and gut. Your heart, head, and gut, your emotions, your cognitive capacities, and your intuition and instinctive capacities. We can be consumed by any one of them. We can get lost in any one of them. And what we need is, they call it the fourth man, which is not very PC, but the fourth person, the fourth human, actually is the one that can integrate these first three. I think of it as it's just a translated, simplified version of all of what we're talking about. It covers integral theory, it covers developmental theory, it covers the wisdom traditions, and it covers the bioenergetic and healing traditions in a way that allows us to put it into practice in our daily lives and have these bite-sized lessons.
So it's a modern, postmodern, metamodern, integral packaging into a busy 21st century person choosing to live a life inside the cacophony of this world and still integrate these experiences without having to go on a 3 months or 9 months or 9 years monastic retreat.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's recapture here your own personal journey. Take me through the early stages where you move from behind the camera to actually teaching and leading groups. And what is that transition like for you, that process?
Yeah, well, I really owe that, the opportunity for that, to Robert McNaught and then Jeff Salzman, who were running the Integral Center here in Boulder. And, you know, this was a very, very special project. We had this big building right near downtown Boulder, and all these workshops were happening. And so for a couple of years, I was still making my profession and supporting myself through doing video. But I was volunteering at every single one of the workshops. So I remember I attended this one workshop, and it was with one of the founders of the Authentic Relating Movement, Decker Kunov, and a very close teacher of mine. And he circled me. So being circled is this thing where you have a whole group of people, sometimes four. I think in this particular workshop, there was like 8 or 9 people in the room. And everyone is focused on you for over an hour. I think we did it for 75 minutes. And they just get radically curious about you. And so it's almost like doing a therapy session where you have 7 therapists. And the amount of consciousness, like, you know, if our consciousness is like a spotlight, you have these 7 spotlights on us, and it just turns up the volume, right? It works really well if you have a skilled facilitator who knows how to actually use this for illuminating developmental lessons that are possible for the person. And, you know, Decker was a master at this. And at some point they were like talking about me and describing me as charismatic and highly relational. And I had a self-concept that said, I'm the geeky skinny guy behind the camera who doesn't relate very well. And really, there was just a self-esteem problem happening. Like I didn't have very high self-esteem at that moment in my life. You know, this is probably 10, 11 years ago. And they started to describe me as charismatic and highly relational. And because their description of me and their experience of me was completely different than my self-concept, it created all this cognitive dissonance. And how do I make sense of this? And it was really like a pebble thrown and like created this little crack in my windshield. And like over the next 2 years, like that just completely expanded and I had to replace the windshield. I was forced to. There was no way I could actually think of myself as the same person after that one 75-minute session.
That's so beautiful. That is a description of an experiential big bang that continues to chain react. And at what point do you consciously tell yourself, yeah, I'm involved with this relational movement. I'm one of the people shaping and helping the blooming of this event, unfolding event. At what point and how is that evolving for you?
Well, for about 2 years after that experience, you know, I paid my dues and I was volunteering as an assistant course leader and really shadowing Robert McNaughton and Decker Kunov and all of the early teachers of what was called T3, which was a 6-month circling training. So we would teach people to lead circling and they would be circled frequently in the process by their peers and by the course leaders. And so, yeah. And in those early days, we had a course called Aletheia as well, which is like this Greek word for aha and like discovering the truth. And that was the experience that would happen sometimes in these circles is like you would wake up to yourself, the truth of who you are in a way that you would not be possible by yourself and would not be possible even, you know, in a one-on-one therapy session. It was really the community. And so the metaphor that I use is like, if you're in community, there's at least two other perspectives telling you who you are. And then there's yourself who's telling you who you are, your self-concept. And you have to actually integrate these three perspectives. Because in normal society, we don't often tell each other how we're experiencing one another. It's kind of taboo. It can be very confronting. And so without the holding and, you know, this is what relational practice is. We're sharing impact of how we're impacting one another. And we're getting very potent information about who we are and how we're showing up. And we're forced to make sense of that. So for 2 years, I was volunteering and being an assistant course leader, and then finally was promoted and kind of got paid to lead my first workshop as one of the junior facilitators. And, you know, I'm very precocious. So I shortly after that started a podcast on authentic relating, and I was leading a lot of 2 and 3 hour events by myself as the main person in the room, leading circling and leading authentic relating games. And I traveled to Amsterdam and New York City and studied with the Circling Europe guys. And I traveled to Austin, Texas to work with my colleague, Sarah Ness, and learn what she was up to. And she's, you know, 16 years younger than me. So she's very much a millennial and her consciousness was different. How she was using this social technology is another word that we use for it. The how she was using it was quite different. And I learned from a lot from her.
And at what point is there an effort or there isn't an effort to systemize or bring together some kind of a unified field of practices and knowledge? How is that dimension evolved?
Came much later. You know, I was teaching circling for several years and, you know, still studying from the people who had founded this field of relational practice. And then I started my own company and developed a 2-day. So a lot of the training was happening in these long workshops. So you would have one weekend a month for 6 months, or, you know, these 3 big workshops over 5 months with the same group of people. And so a lot of them were leadership courses and we would do a really deep dive together. And so I co-founded a company that took all of the authentic relating skills and packaged them into a 2-day course and brought that all over the world. I went to Bali and taught this course 7 times in Bali over the course of a year and trained one of the course leaders out there to continue that Bali project. And I was leading a little bit in Australia and Hawaii, but I also, after Bali, I moved to Amsterdam for 9 months And I was kind of nomadic. I was just on the road for a year and a half, you know, teaching in Europe as well. And once I got burned out from too much travel, that was when the impetus to really write it down started to come into being, which happened last half of 2019 and first half of 2020. And so I, at the time of this recording, published my book about 2 years ago.
Yeah, just in time for what occurred in, over the major transition of 2020. So you write in the book that the practices of authentic relating, inside and within the practices lies a comprehensive toolkit for an individual, community, or society to operate with a balance of love and truth, authenticity and compassion. How would you frame, what must we learn about these polarities, these very important polarities of love and truth and authenticity and compassion?
Yeah, I believe that the foundation of authentic relating is taking multiple perspectives and is polarity. So we have a polarity that we call dignity and humility. And dignity is my voice matters. And humility is the ability to listen to another person. And if either one of these things goes offline, we end up in posture or collapse. So most times when we encounter conflict, we go into posture, which is a lack of humility, or we collapse and we acquiesce to the other and we say, well, your voice matters more than mine. And we go into, yeah, it's a lack of dignity. And so this is a fundamental polarity mapped over the communication that happens in the face of conflict. Whereas I think love and truth or authenticity and compassion is like a little bit more conceptual or philosophical, right? And so what I've really done is I identified these, you know, a couple dozen polarities that are easier to put into practice. And I've taught so many authentic relating workshops in 20 cities around the world. And most often the teaching around dignity and humility is the one that people remember the most and get the most out of, because I think it is this practical polarity that in the moment I can witness myself collapsing because collapsing is a somatic embodied state that I've trained myself to notice.
It's a mental map. It's a mental model that I can immediately ground in my felt experience and register it, and also potentially offers and meets acute need that people we all have in the various experiences that we go through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, please, I want you to lead to then some of the practices. Obviously, your book is just full with tools and practices, and I'm interested that you share some of the practical approach and how, what it is that people actually experience when they enter this field of work.
Yeah, so polarity is, you know, essentially applied Taoism, and it's very influenced. Qigong and Taoism has very much influenced me, but I've really attempted to make it as practical as possible. And so the very first tool I talk in the book is, can we slow down? And some of the tools are named in like very, very plain language. And these are literally words that you can say out loud in a conversation. So what happens, so if we talk about the polarity of authenticity and belonging, which I think is an important one, and this is one that's really fleshed out by Gabor Mate, beautiful Canadian psychologist and beautiful thinker. Basically, when we're children, being rejected by our parents is the same thing as death or being rejected by our caregivers. And so if we're given the choice between authenticity and belonging, which is like speaking up for ourselves or being accepted by the group, we will choose belonging 100% of the time. It's encoded and hardwired into our nervous system. And it's only to the extent that we feel safe and belong that we can start to really speak up for ourselves and really develop our own authenticity. We need to feel safe in the world, right? So many of us just developed communication patterns that's like, when I don't feel safe, I just suppress my own truth, right? So a lot of these things are very practical ways to enact our authenticity in a moment by moment way. So if I say to you, can we slow down? I'm asserting that I need more time and space to actually integrate what's happening. And maybe you're above me in the hierarchy of the business and you're telling me what needs to be done and what has been done wrong. And I'm saying, can we slow down? Right. And in that situation, it's appropriate for me to defer to your authority. Can we slow down? Because I really want to understand what you're saying and I want to be able to put it into practice. And I need actually a little bit more time. I need to go slower. Right. And if you're not too triggered and you understand leadership, you understand that it's actually your job to help me make sure that I can be productive. Right. And so this is a way to assert ourselves. Another one that I look at in chapter 2, which relates to embodiment, is let me check. So instead of saying yes or no in the moment, like so often we say yes, someone asks us for a favor, someone asks us to do something, we say yes, because that's the socially acceptable thing to do, is to be an agreeable human and help and support other people. And we are suppressing our no, because sometimes we say yes, and we have this energetic experience of no underneath. Like, okay, like I'm saying yes out loud, but there's actually dissonance inside of me. And so it's another strategy for like, let me check in with you and I'll get back to you tomorrow. Or let me check in with you and I'll get back to you in an hour. Because we've recognized that our soma or our somatics are giving us messages that we might need time to interpret.
So in these two examples, you are sampling communication, technique, behavioral modality, pragmatic tools of how whatever your background and religious and background and experience, these are simply tools you can use in every situation to help you get in touch with yourself, to help you create a space with others where you can actually reintegrate yourself and reintegrate the experience you're in a way that allows you to be more authentic. That's why it's called authentic relating. But in those first two examples, they represent the idea that the first person you need to become authentic with is yourself, or else there isn't really anything else.
Exactly. Very true. Very true. And authentic relating is a polarity too. You know, sometimes I say how to tell the truth without blowing up your relationships. So we have to learn to tell the truth, but in a way that's actually in relationship with the other. So checking is important of like, this is where I stand. How do you feel about that? You know, this is what's true for me. I also want to know what's true for you. It's like authenticity relating. So it actually can be a pulse back and forth.
So you are leading and flying all over the world and teaching this, and later you're codifying it in the book. What are some of the discoveries in how people are coming into the work and how you continue to evolve the tool set and the experiences?
In the early days, it was a lot of personal growth junkies. It was a lot of people who have done, you know, 10 years of meditation or, you know, 10 years of yoga or done all the workshops. And what I really tried to do when I created The Art of Being Human, which was this 2-day course, is make it more accessible. And two really beautiful experiences. I had a mother in Amsterdam who brought her 16 and 18-year-old sons. And so they came to the course as a family and like all learning these tools and techniques together and practicing together. And it was so beautiful. I think the same workshop, I had one of my volunteers brought her parents as well. And so there was two families in the course. And then in Philadelphia, I had a father who brought his teenage daughter. She was 15. She was very...
So the whole space of family dynamics and family constellation is like pouring into this body of work.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, she was very intelligent and very aware for a 15-year-old. And so she was able to fit in with the adults and do all of the exercises with them. And one of the things that about authentic relating, the culture is, you know, I'll teach for 5 or 10 minutes at a time, but it's like 75% experiential, the exercises, and then hearing insights from other people. And, you know, if someone offers an insight and there's a relevant teaching point, like I'll teach for another 3 to 5 minutes on top of that, but then we go right back into the experiential. And at this workshop in Philadelphia with the father and daughter, they did a demo in front of the room. And it was so stunning because, you know, the father was a little bit domineering in his character, in his, you know, mannerisms. And it was so beautiful to watch her develop the courage to stick up for herself and to watch the father soften and, like, you know, his, what may have come out as domineering and controlling behavior, to watch that soften. And just imagine, I'm not positive, but imagine that that was going to be a skill set for them for the next 5 years of her life as she differentiated from her parents. And he would have access to more softness and access to more, like, well, I really care about you. That's why I want things to happen this way, you know?
And through this work, Jason, what are you discovering about people's capacity to access the tools, the practices in a sustained way, such that it's not just a weekend experience? What is it you're learning about people's capacity to integrate and make the tools true embodied way of being?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very high stakes, right? It's in nearly universal. Our relationships are so important, and they dictate the quality of our life and our nourishment. And so I think people have a lot of incentive to really lean in and learn and absorb these practices and put them into practice because they're suffering. And they're suffering in system or chronic and acute ways in their relationships. When someone they love is in distress, or when they feel unexpressed, or inauthentic in relationship to someone they love, there's just emotional pain that happens, I think, for all of us. So, yeah. And, you know, I'm very, very humble. Like, a lot of what is in the book is a synthesis of so many of the thinkers that we've been talking about in this. I'm honored to, like, help translate them into a little bit more of a practical package.
What's one more practice that you'd want to sample to give a sense and a feeling for somebody that never walked into authentic relating workshop?
Well, you talked about appreciation. You mentioned appreciation in the beginning, and I think of this as the heart of the practice. We give people very specific ways of how to appreciate one another, because it may sound so simple when I say it out loud, but I think sometimes we need really simple emotional education and communication education, because there wasn't actually a class on that when I was in high school. I think it's a little bit different now, but this social emotional education is happening in different ways. And so we give people sentence stems of, like, here's how to appreciate something. It's not about saying thank you or nice job. You know, that saying thank you and nice job is called politeness. It's called being cordial. It's actually not really investing in the relational, they call it the relational capital between us, right? Saying thank you and nice job is like putting pennies in the piggy bank. It doesn't actually do that much. But if you can notice a unique quality that this person is bringing to the community and acknowledge them for it, and even one step better, acknowledge them in front of the other people, of like, wow, Aviv just brings this synthesis, and there's so much heart in the way that he communicates these broad trends. I can really feel his care. Do you guys feel that too? And all of a sudden, what I'm doing is I'm taking this warmth and heart energy, and I'm just spreading it around, and I'm acknowledging you in a way that feels specific and unique.
Yes, beautiful. Thank you. So one can be immersed inside the discovery of this work for what it is. One can embrace it because there is a need. This is not a modality seeking a need. There is a need that this modality is answering. And one can also try, kind of circling back to where we were earlier in conversation, to see it inside the even bigger context of what is occurring now. And so, given all that we are reflecting on and given everything you are sharing, what is the story you have in mind about this evolutionary moment and the nature of the shift underway, that authentic relating and stepping into owning this relational space, or more fully embodying it more fully? What's the bigger story you have in mind about this time and the significance of this work?
Well, I think the socioeconomic realities are that, and I'm going to say something dramatic, and then I'm going to qualify that statement. I think capitalism is killing us. Yeah. And I don't mean that we need to abolish capitalism as an economic system. I mean that we need to stop capitalizing on people. We need to stop looking at people as commodities and people as their labor to be capitalized on. Like, if you have a great idea and you develop a product and you pay your people a fair wage and you honor them as full human beings and you make millions of dollars on the product, that's really good for humanity. That's really, like, capitalism is far better than most economic systems out there, right? This is integral. We have this word conscious capitalism, right? That's what I just described. But if you have a really good idea and your workers are, you know, really don't have any luxury of the ability to have, you know, good relationships, healthy food, you're not really caring about the wellness of the people doing the work at all, and then you make millions of dollars, this is what I call evil, because it's a slightly less evil form of slavery.
It's modern feudalism.
Yes.
So you are, let me say back to you, in my words, what I think you just told me. Mm-hmm. We have entered a phase shift in the evolution of modern, postmodern societies, where we are rushing quickly to a point where the extractive, exploitative, capitalistic system that brought us the economic miracle of the last two centuries is reaching a dead end on so many different fronts, environmentally, energy-wise, but the focus of the work you're doing, that it has reached a point that, where, as you're saying, it's killing us, it is a dead end because human beings are no longer prepared. New generations are no longer prepared to play the game. And a big change is coming, or is here, and the authentic relating toolset is one way to integrate some ancient and modern practices as a facility to enable the change and to potentially not have to do a complete revolution in the historic sense of a destruction that leads to a rebirth, but rather a transformation from inside the system. That's what I heard you just offered me.
Yeah, absolutely. Listening to the people who are lower in the hierarchy and lower in power and lower in privilege is something that authentic relating can teach us to do really, really well. And it's really needed, and it's really needed in the business world. Like, just simply listening. So if I listen to someone who is, you know, experiencing pain and suffering as a result of the working conditions, well, as the person with more power and privilege, if I'm actually bringing empathy into the situation, and true listening involves empathy, then I am forced to improve those things. Improve those working conditions. And it's the same trend. There's a reason why we have child labor laws, is because this trend started, you know, back in the 40s. Before that, we didn't actually have child labor laws, right? And so I think it is coming to a precipice the way you're talking about, because we externalize the negative consequences of something in a system to the point where there's just so much trash happening outside of the system. And then we experience the negative effects more and more the more we capitalize.
The externalities overwhelm the system and bring about an implosion, a collapse. And that pattern is appearing in different systems from different perspectives and different lens.
Yep.
So, and you brought empathy, just a specific inquiry there. In your experience, that people are coachable in discovering, in building the empathy muscle, how would you describe that? Because for somebody who comes into this space, who is not naturally attune into it, often we will discover that they needed to experience something very painful, very difficult in their life, breakdown of relationship or money or health or something, to potentially open up and sense into empathy. But how would you frame the teaching of empathy and people's capacity to absorb it?
Yeah, people can learn it without crisis if they have exercises that's like, here's an exercise in listening, and they have the humility to say, you know, I know how to listen at this level, but listening is an advanced skill and we can grow in listening through our whole lives. Right. So it's reframing some of these basic skills that we think we have, because advanced listening is opening our heart and opening our somatic being to receive the energetic emotional information of the other person. And, you know, it's a very paltry or poor way to listen, to keep your heart shut and just listen with your ears. And so people can come to this insight of like, oh, my heart and my being is not open because I'm afraid that I'm going to, you know, experience a loss of power or a loss of money if I actually listen to you. So let me, right? And we just need the education. So I think the world of business, you know, that's why my project is called Authentic at Work, is a very huge leveraged place right now. But it's also just starting, how do we teach people who are, you know, 13, 14, 15 years old about how to handle their emotions and about what it means to be triggered and about emotional education. And I think that project is happening. And that's the project that's going to save us 20 and 30 years from now when those people grow up.
Right. So bringing this into the educational system, I remember writing a letter to my son when he was in high school. And I wrote to him that the three most important skills they will not teach him in school. One is managing his emotions and feelings. Second, managing his energy. And thirdly, managing his relationship. And then also learning how to manage his money. So you are seeing that this movement is also has entered the youth space and entering mainstream school experience?
Slowly. Yeah, I do believe it's happening. I do believe like the materialism and the achievement at all costs nature of our culture is breaking down. And, you know, it's like we need to balance material success with achievement, with listening and empathy, with healthy relationships, with wellness and you know, how we eat and with how we treat the planet, right? This holistic consciousness is growing.
So you're leading Authentic at Work. There is authentic movement into education and certainly the 12 to 16 to 18 age in terms of its formative experience. Is there any other frontier that you'd point to that where there is important transformative work that's emerging out of this movement at this time? Like, for example, in influencing politics or influencing that difficult space?
Yeah, I think integral politics and the thought process and the concept around it is well formed, but I don't think the people playing the political game are actually interested in that. So... yeah, unfortunately, that particular topic brings in my pessimism a little bit, because I think the algorithms that are shaping our social media feeds are increasing polarization, and we don't have the ability to listen to the people on the other side of the political aisle. So I think authentic relating could play a role in that, but I don't, you know, I once had an idea of like, I want to go around and interview everyday people and, you know, put conservatives and progressives into a room and get them to listen to each other and film it and tell the story that way. I have heard of projects that are doing things like this, but I just don't know if the people who run for office or at a state or national level are really interested in this idea at all. They have too much incentive for securing their own power base. So, but I'm open to that possibility.
Well, to not end this on a pessimistic note, let me ask you, what any other intuitions about how this movement is to continue to evolve in the coming decade, or any other intuition about this space and work and about yourself inside it that you want to share?
I think the generations are getting closer together, or they're getting shorter. And so like the TikTok generation, and, you know, I think they're going to be so radically different in orientation that, and I think what technology is doing to our consciousness is something that we are going to wake up to very quickly. I think the most important book released this year is Stolen Focus by Johan Hari. And I think it cuts across all, it's a concern for all of humanity. It's like, you know, back in the 70s, there was these CFC chemicals that were putting a hole in the ozone, right? Al Gore used this example in his environmental work. And this was creating all kinds of problems. It was thinning the ozone layer. It was, you know, killing the apex predators. So the hawks and the eagles were, you know, their shells were becoming thinner and thinner. And we had to band together, not as a country, but as a planet to ban these chemicals. And if we hadn't done that back in the 70s, our society would have already collapsed. I think one could make a case for that.
So you're making the case that the current ozone depletion layer is relational.
It's relational and it's attentional.
Attentional.
Our ability to focus on meaningful things like a career, you know, our ability to commit to a relationship long enough to raise a family, you know, like I think there's so many erosions that big tech and smartphones are having on us that we're going to have to deal with it as an entire culture. And yeah, so I think that's coming.
So how about if we end this fascinating exploration with you on this rallying call to attend to the attentional and relational ozone layer that's depleting, and the discovery, the realization that actually the regenerative replenishing capacities are right here inside each one of us, and we have the capacity to replenish and regenerate the attentional and the relational spaces for our own health and for the health of the of humanity and the planet at large.
Yeah, it's happening. I notice it in a lot of people in my life that are self-employed like me. You know, it's like we get together and we just work next to each other in the coffee shop, or we get together and we work next to each other on Zoom. And there's something about that, my energy supporting you and your energy supporting me, that allows us to focus and be less distracted by social media. Yeah. And so I think we're going to develop structures that actually heal our attention span. And those are relational structures for work.
I appreciate so very much how you brought the experience of the journey and the practical, the pragmatic side together with the visionary side, the whole of it together, because that's what we need. We need the practical tools and the vision and the philosophical historic context and the whole bigger story and the capacity to hold that big picture and at the same time be so grounded in the here and now. How can the two of us, how can the small circle that we are step up to a whole new way of being and doing and functioning together? And that's what I have experienced in the story you share and what you embody. So thank you.
Thank you, Aviv. Yeah. And you make it easy. I love the way your mind works. And I hope we get to have many more conversations like this.
Thank you for listening to Portals of Perception. If you're enjoying these dialogues, we'd love it if you'd leave a rating and a review at ratethispodcast.com/portals. Visit portalsofperception.org for exclusive content. Please share this episode with a friend and be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.